From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. From Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and welcome to this evening's edition of Tuesday Topics. I'd like to thank Brian Charlson, our producer, and as it turns out, our co-presenter tonight, for his constant participation in Tuesday Topics. And as usual, I'd like to express my appreciation to Steve Bauer, who over the last couple of weeks in particular has had lots of duty to do in terms of producing Tuesday Topics and turning it into meaningful programs, sometimes with relatively short turnaround times. Thank you, Mr. Bauer. And as usual, thank you to George Byes of Talking Communities for the opportunity to utilize Talking Communities software that makes these programs possible. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're going to explore, I suppose, some history, but also we're going to be talking about differences among organizations. And as we get close to election time and start thinking about government, maybe it's not such a bad thing for us to focus on government within ACB. And so we thought it might be interesting to talk about both where the ACB came from in terms of its attitudes towards democracy and who it is and what it is, and also perhaps talk a little bit about some of the historical events that have occurred throughout our history where the relationship between ACB and its affiliates has been an issue, or where ACB has or has not chosen to get involved in affiliate affairs. So to kind of co-present these things with me, I had asked Brian Charlson if he'd join me, and maybe, Brian, you could start off by setting the background. When ACB was formed way back in 1961, do you think that the form of government was an issue and that our history affected the way our Constitution was written?
There's no doubt that our history did affect how our Constitution was written and the attitude of the framers of that Constitution. In the same way that the Constitution of the United States was affected by the few men who were associated with the framing of our national Constitution. Specifically, because we were talking about a group of individuals who were discontented within the National Federation of the Blind, the single and only organization of the blind at the time, and how recent events had taken place during the national convention of that organization. A number of individuals left the conference hall and crossed the street to another hotel and proceeded to sit down and describe what they would want in a perfect organization, and much of what they penned at that time was the result of a reaction to what they had just experienced. I would say one of the biggest examples of that is the separation between the press and the leadership within ACB. The whole concept of the Board of Publications as a separate entity overseeing the publication so that it could not be utilized as a mouthpiece exclusively in the hands of the top echelon of the organization. I don't think that would have been in there had it not been for that historical experience. What do you think?
Yep, I absolutely agree with you. I think the other thing that we need to probably look at as one of the major framing elements of our Constitution was a discontent with the degree to which a few people were assuming power within the National Federation of the Blind, and also the degree to which that central power ignored the wishes of individual affiliates. I think it's also important to remember that ACB and NFB are both really organizations that are made up of affiliates rather than members. While we certainly do allow members at large, if you look at ACB's constitution and if you look at NFB's constitution, both are organizations of organizations. And it really is affiliates who are the primary members of ACB and who are at the heart of our constitution and of NFB's. Now, with NFB, each affiliate got one vote, and that was that. When ACB put its constitution together, the situation was very different, and there were a number of ways that our constitution was written to protect the rights of affiliates, and not only affiliates, but to protect the rights of smaller affiliates against larger affiliates. Maybe you could talk a little bit about some of those components, Brian.
Keep in mind, continues to be a bone of contention with ACB to this day. Because ACB wanted to reflect in some fashion through the voting process the number of members back home that are members of the ACB affiliates, it was determined to provide each affiliate one vote for every 25 members or the major part thereof. So if your organization had a number divisible by 25 plus 13 or more, then you would get that additional vote. But with a cap on it, that is that no one affiliate could get more than 25 delegate votes. This allowed organizations to have some form of proportional voting, but also guarded against a very few large affiliates controlling the entire organization to the detriment of the smaller affiliates. This is still a bone of contention within ACB to this day, because while we cap the number of votes allowed by affiliates, we do not cap the amount of dues each affiliate pays on a per-member basis. And I know that especially our friends from the larger states such as California, let's see, who else would it be, Missouri, Florida, that they have some concern about a variation of that question of taxation without representation, that is, being forced to pay dues for individuals whose numbers do not swell the organization's authority in terms of votes at the national convention.
Yeah, but actually there is a cap on dues. People only pay dues for the 25 members or for the 25 votes that they have. They send in their whole membership list, but I don't think they have to pay dues for everybody. I mean, you've been the treasurer, so you may be right, but I'm pretty certain that I'm correct. The issue is that you do have a lot of representation that, in fact, is not being counted as votes. You know, if you take an affiliate like California, they have upwards of 2,000 members, and they're only allowed to count up to 625 of those members when they vote. So that's certainly an issue. Whether it's taxation without representation or not, I don't think is as much the issue as it is that large affiliates don't feel like they're treated with the degree of respect that they're due. But those aren't the only ways that our Constitution made sure that ACB would be different from NFB. Would you say that in putting together our Constitution, there was any consideration given to creating a strong board of directors and a strong central authority, or do you think just the opposite was intended?
Well, let me first deal with the previous question for a moment. The other thing that creates the balance when it came to affiliates is that a vote for a elective office or any vote that is called a record vote is comprised of the delegate vote plus a standing vote of those in attendance who are registered as members of the national organization, not just the at-large folks, but also those who are members by way of their membership to an affiliate. So that also acted as a bit of a check and balance to size versus, and also geographic location, because naturally if a convention was held in a given state, there'd be a heavier attendance from that state than from other states, that kind of thing. Now going back to this issue of creating a system that would keep there from being an overly strong executive, if you will, within the organization. We have two things that are in place to deal with that. One is a limit on how many individuals can hold office from a given state. Within the board of directors, there are two classes of members. There are those that are officers and those who are general directors. And we cannot have more than one general director from a given state. There is no such limitation placed on the officers, however. The other part of that process that keeps there from being a strong centralized authority is term limits. We limit officers to no more than 3 consecutive terms in their office, so that would mean 7 years, that is 3 consecutive full terms and 1 partial term, and for general directors, 2 consecutive terms, and therefore they could do the 8 years that represents those 2 4-year terms plus 2 years of a partial term. So we do create those balances by limiting geographic representation and also limiting terms.
The history of ACB has been that the boards of directors also tended to pay a lot of deference to affiliates all the way through our history. Didn't even call the person who was in charge of our national office an executive director. For a long time called him a national representative to try to make it clear that power within ACB was going to reside with the board, and that the board saw itself as representing the affiliates that were out there, whether they were state affiliates or special interest affiliates, it didn't really matter. If we look at affiliates a little bit more, have there been situations in the history of ACB where the board of directors has come into conflict, if you like, with any of the affiliates of ACB, or for the most part, have affiliates through our history found themselves at odds with what the board of directors is doing and expressed that concern?
Certainly. Keeping in mind that I served on the board for 23 years and ACB had a significant history prior to that and has had a bit of history in this subject since I left the board, I can come up with a few. One area dealt with when an affiliate takes exception to a resolution passed on the national level and then takes opposite action within their state or as an affiliate. 2 times in recent memory such things occurred. One was in the state of Hawaii, as we were dealing with the issue of quarantine and guide dog users. The Hawaii affiliate and the guide dog users affiliate disagreed on what ought to take place there. A resolution was passed by the national organization in support of changing the quarantine, but the Hawaii affiliate chose not to support that, including going before hearings within the state of Hawaii. ACB's national board became involved in, if you will, negotiating an understanding between their 2 affiliates. One who claims that the local affiliate ought to be bound to the resolution passed by the national organization, and one who disagreed with that. Another time, there was a conflict, again, this time between guide dog users and their concerns about the rights of a guide dog using member in the state of Iowa. and the Iowa State affiliate. The Iowa State affiliate wanted to take one approach toward dealing with the denial of service, while the guide dog user group wanted to take an opposing approach toward this. And again, the ACB National Board became involved more as a broker of, a broker that assisted the two organizations in finding a way to live in some level of peace, I guess. And were pretty successful at keeping it from driving major wedges between the affiliates. Those would be two substantive issues where two or more ACB affiliates found themselves in disagreement and spoke to the issue of when a nationally stated policy was adopted by the national organization, ought it to be seen by an affiliate as taking precedence over affiliates' involvement in a particular national issue.
In the case of the Hawaii Association and the position they took with regard to guide dogs, it's probably worth mentioning that eventually they actually helped to craft the legislation that ended up going into effect there. But the point that I wanted to make as well about the Hawaii Association is, even though the position that they were taking was at odds with a national policy, the Hawaii Association never faced the likelihood of being expelled from ACB, and indeed, for the most part, they took their position, and the national board saw its role at the time as trying to work with. There were, in fact, two affiliates in Hawaii, to work with both affiliates to try to get the national stuff done, but also to try to be sure that the two affiliates that were in Hawaii played nice. And we could probably say the same thing, don't you think, Brian, about the Iowa situation. Even though a position was taken at the national level by resolution with regard to the Iowa situation, which the Iowa affiliate felt very strongly about, the fact is the Iowa affiliate was able to take that position with relative impunity, and it really was never in any serious danger either of finding itself being told either you toe the line or get the heck out. It would seem that affiliates within ACB do have a fair amount of strength, and that if you tried to look at ACB's constitution, what we would see a lot of times is that affiliates have, in many respects, more power even than the National Board of ACB. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm going to say a qualified yes. I do think the affiliates have, if you will, the trump card, that if an affiliate takes one point of view and the national organization takes another, it wouldn't rise to a level to give the national organization the necessary clout to do anything about it. So what they've generally speaking done is discuss, arbitrate, those kinds of things, but pretty much as a matter of goodwill rather than a matter of authority to do anything about the task. We have very strict methods for expelling an affiliate or expelling a member, and the types of conflicts that we're describing would not meet the requirements for such an expulsion. So if that is the only means of, if you will, disciplining an affiliate, then clearly the power rests with the affiliate. There are times when the national has more clout than the affiliate. If it's a national issue as opposed to a state issue, then clearly we have more resources on the national level to lobby for that point of view. We have a process of resolutions. We can enlist the involvement of all the affiliates who are in agreement with the national stand to support it, and there's no problem with that. On the other hand, that National's not going to come to the support of a local affiliate to support a point of view that the National organization as a whole hasn't already adopted. So, again, it's that checks and balances between resources and the right to dissent within the organization.
There were some other situations where the ACB board became involved with affiliates, and I can think of three. One had to do with trying to broker a unified chapter in California. One had to do with trying to deal with conflict in Kentucky, and another had to do with conflict in Virginia. And what all three of these instances had in common was they were situations where an affiliate and members of that affiliate were having difficulty. And in all three of those cases, what we ended up with, at least for a while, were two affiliates in those states. By the way, I guess that was also true in Washington, huh, Brian?
It certainly was at one point, though ACB was not as involved, as I understand it, in the brokering of that final resolution.
Oh, I think ACB was involved. At least, yeah. I think so. But nevertheless, the interesting thing is, while we have two affiliates in Kentucky still, those two affiliates are currently working pretty harmoniously together. And while we have two affiliates in Virginia, the acrimony that existed at one point seems to have dissipated. And in the case of California, of course, we did create a single affiliate, and the same thing was true in Washington. So in those cases, I guess an affiliate or ACB and the affiliates have actually been able to work together to actually be pretty successful at solving problems. So I guess that what we can say to kind of summarize the situation is there certainly are checks and balances, and the power of affiliates sort of waxes and wanes. I think that the kind of situation that ACB has had throughout its history has made it difficult for a president to govern. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to say one more thing about the dual affiliates thing. In the case of both Washington and California, this is where a previous ACB affiliate existed. When an NFB affiliate broke away or was expelled, chose to exist independently at first and eventually merged both the former NFB and the pre-existing ACB affiliate into a single affiliate. The Virginia scenario, there was already an ACB affiliate, another group of individuals organized around kind of a different issue than the one that pre-existed, and they remained two separate affiliates. And I believe a similar situation exists in the state of Kentucky. So, harder for an ACB president to manage than one where the power comes from the central organization and is spread among the affiliates. I think absolutely it's harder for a president to govern under those circumstances. Many times I'm asked, what is the biggest difference between ACB and NFB? And I really do think that the biggest difference is ACB chooses to err in the direction of allowing diverse opinion at the cost of unity and a unified voice, while NFB gives up that diverse set of opinions in the name of unity and a single voice.
Well, as somebody who actually was president of ACB, I can certainly agree with that, because it's much harder to make a quick decision in ACB, even if a quick decision is called for, than it is, say, in NFB, where essentially, you know, as the leader, that whatever you say essentially goes. I think, though, that in order to be complete, we probably need to say that there was a recognition in our strategic plan that was written, oh, I guess in 1995, that the decentralization of ACB actually weakened our ability to act effectively. And there was a push in that plan for us to move towards a stronger central authority, not by giving power to the president, though, but by actually daring to name the person who was in charge of the national office, the executive director, and giving that executive director a good deal more authority in the day-to-day operation of ACB, so that it wouldn't only be the president who could be perceived as the face of ACB, but to a very real extent, the executive director could be perceived as the face of ACB as well. And I, for one, felt that direction was a good one. I think in the last 6 years, we've swung back the other way, with the president assuming more power and the board assuming more power and perhaps less power residing in the national office. And we'll have to wait and see what happens with this new administration, or perhaps with our new plan. But there wasn't a radical alteration of the Constitution. In that document, it simply asked that the organization recognize that if we were going to become a power player, we needed to have more strength at the center, and we shouldn't constantly have to go back and ask before we do anything. It shouldn't be mummy may I. We're big children now. We're not a little kid. We've demonstrated that we can be trusted as a government and as a national office, and it's time that you guys actually trusted us and allowed us to do the job that you pay us to do, kind of thing. So, I don't know, would you agree that in the last 6 years we've moved back in the other direction, Brian?
Without a question. I'd also say that so much of that unwritten, or even in a planning document written but not in the Constitution written decision, the implementation of it has so much to do with the personalities. Who is the current president? Who is the current executive director? How much does the current board place, how much power does the current board place in the hands of the president by how committees are established and when the president is authorized by motion by the board to do certain things, or the executive director is empowered by a motion of the board to do certain other things, and how those two individuals get along, for that matter. All of that's going to have an impact on that balance of power between the elected and the employed leadership of ACB.
It's an element of governance that we haven't talked about, and it's an interesting one because it seems to at least to some degree be at odds with the rest of the governance. The other way that things get done in ACB is through committees, and these committees are spelled out in the Constitution, but virtually all of them, I say virtually all of them because there are a couple of exceptions, but virtually all of them are entirely appointed by the president. Does this in fact run counter to the idea that that we're not giving the president a lot of power?
Well, they are appointed by the president for the most part. There are some radical differences with some of the more powerful committees. For example, the executive committee is actually made up of the president and two members of the officer group, elected by the officer group, and two members of the directors, again, elected by the director. So again, the president doesn't appoint any members to that committee. In other cases, the committees have certain individuals who are there by rights of their other positions. So, for example, the chair of the board of publications, or the what would be another example? That's the one that sticks out in my mind. Somebody who for that matter, the treasurer might serve on certain committees because he or she is the treasurer, and that's laid out in the description of what that standing committee is supposed to consist of. So I think that there are some minor checks and balances to the authority of committees. It's also true that just like the national government, the committees are only as powerful as the funds they wield. And if you take a look at the ACB budget, it does not place much in the way of finance in the hands of committees. They deal more with establishing policies which in turn must be adopted by the national organization, i.e. board of directors, before they can be implemented. So I think that there's a fair amount of checks and balances in that process.
Well, and I think the other factor with committees is that committees are made up of volunteers, and volunteers notoriously are not necessarily the best workers in the world. And I think, in fact, what presidents have certainly done, I guess that you and I started it, but we appointed, in fact, officer liaisons to try to help committees to function more appropriately and more effectively, because, again, we didn't want necessarily them to be perceived as the creatures of the president, but rather wanted them to perform the functions that they were set up to perform. And therefore, we were perfectly content to have other officers actually oversee those committees, to sort of perhaps even crack a whip a little bit to try to see if they could get anything done. That's the balance of power. I'll ask you one last question, and then I'm going to open it up. Can you contrast what we've been talking about with your reading of the NFB Constitution and the kind of organization that the NFB is, some of the differences, so that people can understand just how different our two organizations are in terms of governance? By the way, the NFB would say they're less different than I think Brian and I would say they are.
Well, keeping in mind that a great deal of the differences, again, have to do with that imponderable, the personality, there are a couple of examples of significant differences. One is the issue of term limits. We're very, very consistent in our application of term limits. During the years that I've been involved in ACB, 8 presidents have served. Not all of them have served the maximum of 6 years, that is 3 consecutive 2-year terms, but most of them have. And again, they were elected. Not necessarily did a vice president or first vice president become president. And not only individuals that were already members of the board were elected as presidents. So we've seen quite a bit of diversity in our board of directors as a result of that, something that is not reflected in NFB's leadership. Secondly, we have a clear difference between paid staff and volunteered elected officials. Many, I don't know the precise number, but many members of the NFB's elected core also hold some form of position. Certainly Mark Maurer does, in terms of an occupation associated with the position of president of the organization. I can't remember, I think he's currently an attorney for the American Brotherhood, which is a wholly owned entity of NFB. So he gets paid as well as being an elected official, though he's not being paid one for the other. Also, as you mentioned earlier, there's this issue of each affiliate has a single vote, so there's not proportional voting that takes place within NFB. It's much more akin, say, to the U.S. Senate than it is the checks and balances of a bicameral type legislative process that allows for proportional voting up to a point of the affiliate vote and the standing vote as well. So I would say those are some examples of the differences. And I guess lastly, by the very fact that every one of the initial members of the NFB, and we're talking about when there was just a single organization, every initial affiliate that formed the NFB in the day of its founding have eventually been kicked out or quit the NFB and joined the ACB. As a result of that whole process, you can see how easy it is for NFB to expel affiliates and expel members. Again, something that ACB has a real abhorrence about doing and makes very, very difficult in its governing organ.
The specifics of expulsion have only, in fact, been added to our Constitution relatively recently, and that primarily speaks to the removal of a board member, though by extension I think it would apply to an affiliate or a member if we felt the need to do that. I guess the one other thing that I would add about two things about the Federation first. There is a general recognition on the part of the members that the leadership, that is the board of directors, and then the executive committee or the officers as a subgroup of that make all of the decisions for NFB. They don't have a lot of power in making those decisions, and they would say they've happily ceded authority to this central group because quality rises to the top. They've identified the folks who are their strongest folks and who are the people they want to have as their leaders, and those are in fact the folks who run the organization, and so it is as it should be. The other thing that I would say is the Federation would tell you that there in fact is a lot more democracy within the Federation than we give it credit for in ACB, and that democracy is subtle and exercised by the leadership at the top, listening closely to what its membership want. And they would argue that the only reason their system works is because they listen very closely to what their members say and to what their affiliates say, and at least to a degree act accordingly. If they didn't, they say, they would be thrown out on their ear, they say. So I think it's time we opened this up for other people who might have a couple of questions or comments on our discussion of kind of the history of affiliate relations and federations versus confederations. So who'd like to jump in and be first? And remember to tell us who you are and where you come from.
Hello, everyone. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I think that I compare NFB and ACB this way. I think that NFB is a top-down organization and ACB is a bottom-up organization and more of a grassroots thing. And I think that's the better way to go. I think leadership is good, I think is important, but I think it's up to all of us to do our share. I mean, even the affiliates to do our part to make ACB what it can be, I guess.
This is Alice Richard from Brunswick, Georgia. And I guess with what you're saying, a couple of things. I certainly, and the reason I chose the ACB over the NFB was because of the fact that I felt like it was truly more of an affiliate actually having a say and not being dictated to, so to speak, like the NFB. But there are times that I find that it's frustrating because I think especially when we come to legislative issues and things, and I know there have been times when I've asked, you know, for help from the national on getting legislative things through, and it's like, well, it's up to the states need to do that, and I think we'd do better at times if there are certain situations when I think we need to be more, and I hate to say it, but in that sense more like the NFB in that we're more united, because I think it hurts us legislatively.
Alice, I agree with that, and that was one of the reasons why I was as pushy as I was about trying to create a stronger central authority. And it's always been my view that there's nothing that precludes the national organization, whether it's through the national office or through the board of directors, from helping a state work on a legislative issue. You know, I went to a number of states when I was president when there were legislative problems and worked with them talking to legislators or speaking to legislatures. I can certainly remember going to North Carolina and taking part in a march there, and going to Wisconsin when their school for the blind was in danger of closing, and a number of other states as well. Consulting with Illinois when their rehab system was being changed. There was a sense in which Illinois, just to be fair about it, found that I was a little bit too pushy. This was relatively early in my time as president, and I think they would have been happier had I been less vocal there. And perhaps they're right. It's an indication of how strong affiliates are that they could express their unhappiness and persuade me that I ought to shut up. The point, though, that you make is a really strong one, because that's one of the areas where I think we really are weaker, in that if a legislative issue comes up that we haven't spoken to by resolution, we really need to, if we're obeying the letter of the law, get authority from somebody before we jump in there, whereas the Federation can jump in right away and take advantage of situations that we often aren't able to because of our need to consult with others. Other comments or issues? Are there other things we like or don't like about what ACB does and how we do it?
Paul, I wonder if you might mention the Missouri situation you found yourself in. I think that was during your presidency, where the Missouri affiliate made comments. Can you fill us in on that one?
Yeah, it wasn't one that got a lot of publicity because it really didn't need to, but there was a situation where Missouri decided that they were going to file a lawsuit that involved ACB and that involved our position, but they didn't even see fit to let us know that they were going to do it. And as president, that didn't make me very happy because suddenly I'm getting calls from Missouri about actions that an affiliate has taken, and I'm completely out in the cold. Now, an affiliate has the right to act on its own, but if you're part of a family, it seems to me only reasonable that you consult with the dad or consult with somebody who is an elder in the family if you're going to take a radical step. So my primary issue, well, I had two issues. First, ACB really ought not to be named in a suit unless you ask us first. And second, I don't think that an affiliate ought to take actions without at least informing ACB and talking about it a little. And I think that's all part of where this whole affiliate rights and responsibilities movement came from, because it's certainly my view that at least to a degree, the whole question of what an affiliate's duties are to the national organization and what the national organization's duties are to an affiliate has never been very well spelled out. Well, I think our affiliate rights and responsibilities document does a good job, but for the most part, people probably haven't taken that document very seriously.
One of the other things, Paul, that I find interesting, I'm not sure I'd use the word troubling, but certainly something that I'd like to have a better grasp of, is when there are conflicts between the ACB Constitution and one of its affiliates' constitutions, when does ACB have the right, as it currently stands, And should they have the right to have any impact on that? Give me a couple examples. ACB's national constitution indicates that you must be 18 years of age or older to be a voting member at large. If an affiliate has in their constitution that an individual has to be 16 years of age, or does not specify an age minimum, does the national organization have the authority, and where is that, to impose that on the constitution of the affiliate?
Well, of course, I think it would depend on what ACB member you talk to. This ACB member would say that ACB does have the authority to intervene. I don't think we're actually doing a good job at the national level, not nearly so good a job, by the way, as we do in Florida. In Florida, we're in an interesting situation because we're an affiliate with a bunch of chapters. We have 25 chapters in Florida. And we have a Constitution and Bylaws Committee that is not only required to take a look at the Constitution of any organization that is choosing to affiliate as a chapter, but is also required to approve an affiliate's constitution every time it changes. And frankly, that's what I think should be being done at the national level within ACB. Right now, whenever a group seeks admission to the American Council of the Blind, their constitution is looked at by the national office right now with a view to establishing whether it, in fact, is appropriate in the context of the American Council of the Blind. And by definition, I think that includes having components that are analogous with the ACB Constitution. I believe that membership ought to be one of those where a constitution should be analogous. So if somebody submitted to the national office a constitution that said that anybody could vote at the age of 16, I would send it back to them and say, this does not correspond with ACB. In order for you to be admitted, you're going to have to comply with the same rules that operate at the national constitution, which is you have to be 18 years of age or older in order to be a voting member of ACB. I think that's reasonable. We were already looking at things like, are 50% of or more of your members blind? Are all of your officers blind? If not, is there a rational reason why not? Because there was a time when I think ACB actually allowed folks who had sight, I think, could be treasurer for a while in ACB's constitutional history. But the point that I'm making is I think that there is a requirement that there be some correspondence between the ACB Constitution and the affiliate Constitution.
You said that one of the aspects that the two constitutions should be in conformance with is the age requirements of membership. That, of course, is only enforceable if ACB is actually collecting age information when it's requesting its affiliates to send in its information. And I do not believe age is listed as one of the pieces of information on each individual. So it would be impossible currently to police that in the first place. Secondly was the blind versus not blind ratio. That's not the aspect of a single individual, but the collective, if you will. And certainly that's in our Constitution that a majority of members of any affiliate need to be blind. And again, we ask in the membership list, is this individual blind or not blind during the whole credentialing process? So I would say, in general, the quiet, over-the-transom kind of an approach toward negotiating some reasonable relationship between the features of a national constitution and the features of affiliate constitutions need to kind of be there.
I think it's actually a pretty appropriate thing because it lessens the likelihood of conflict down the road because we know that these folks are doing things in approximately the same way as we are. And I think it also says something about being a member of a state affiliate is a big deal. And if you want to be a member of our state affiliate, then you have to play the game our way, or you have to abide by standards and rules. And I think there's a lot to be said for the national organization taking a similar position, even though, as you say, we'd have to rewrite our constitution and bylaws to make that appropriate. Let me see if Brian wants to make one final comment, and then we will wind tonight's program down.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I think matter here. One is, when something isn't written down in a constitution or in a policy manual that has the authority behind it, that is, that it was voted upon and has the support of the membership, that kind of thing, then it's really catch-as-catch-can when it comes to when you choose to impose authority and when you choose not to impose authority. So it becomes a very ragged approach. You might choose to do something in one case and choose not to do it in a very similar case, and nobody has any way of knowing when you're going to pounce and when you're not going to pounce on a given issue. You also have a problem whenever you create a process after the fact. Had we incorporated in the initial constitution, prior to accepting affiliates to ACB, a process by which we would regularly review and have the right of refusal of amendments to constitutions, then I think it could have been a good and doable thing. After the fact, however, I think you're right in what you intimated earlier, all hell would break loose on the ACB floor if somebody were to introduce such a practice today in ACB. Lastly, I would dearly love to see a document that would indicate what the minimum components of an affiliate constitution ought to be. During the years that affiliates were accepted while I was on the board, the constitution was placed in the hands of the executive director, or prior to them, the national representative. They reviewed it, and on an agenda item, they were asked by the board of directors to indicate that the constitution was acceptable or was not. They were never asked to explain to the board what made it acceptable if they indicated it was acceptable. Occasionally it was delayed because the executive director / national representative was concerned about one component or the other, and they might or might not share that with us. But usually it just led to a postponement to the next meeting, at which time we were assured that all things had been resolved and we would move on. The proof is in the pudding. You can say that the national should have the authority to insist on certain standards within the affiliates with respect to constitutions, both their initial submission and their later amending. But in reality, ACB has pretty much stayed away from any kind of enforcement process. I'd also be curious someday in hearing, other than expulsion, which I don't think would ever go over, and I don't believe it should actually go over, what other disciplinary action can the national organization have with respect to the actions of its affiliates? Right now, there's clearly only one, and even that one is carefully written within the Constitution to be under certain circumstances and not under others, and this is not being reflected there at all. I guess that would be my read of the situation at this point, Paul.
I don't have time to make all the comments that I'd like to make, Mr. Brian. Let me say just two things. Number one, I think that you're absolutely right that it would be difficult to impose a new set of values. I'm not sure that it isn't something that we should do, nevertheless. I think just because it's difficult and people don't like it doesn't necessarily make it a bad thing to do. Second, with regard to penalties, I'm not sure that many organizations have a lot aside from expulsion that they can do, And I'm not sure that within ACB, expulsion would really be that big a deal for a lot of the organizations with whom we might come into conflict in any case. So I'm not sure what the penalties would be, but I think that most of the time, you view the Constitution another way. Instead of saying you're out of compliance with ACB's Constitution, what we say is, we want you to come into compliance with ACB's Constitution because you respect the organization, because you value ACB, because you believe in us as a national organization, and even though we're not going to tell you what to do all the time, we absolutely and categorically believe that you owe us the respect as an organization with whom you've chosen to affiliate to bring your Constitution into alignment with ours. That's what I would say about that. And I would love to give you the opportunity to respond, and I guess I will.
I don't disagree that respect is what really drives this. Again, we've been talking about ACB's national leadership speaking with affiliates in an effort to try to create some amicability between affiliates that disagree with one another, affiliates that are taking action that is not consistent with the national policy, these kinds of things. And we've been pretty effective. It hasn't always been clean and straightforward. I don't mean clean meaning that it's been dirty. I just mean that it hasn't been smooth and perfect with all the corners smoothed out. But it certainly has been effective. We continue to exist these many years later. We've amended our Constitution innumerable times, sometimes amending it back to the way it used to be in the process of many years of amending. It's still a Constitution I'm proud to be affiliated with through my membership and through the time I was a leader within ACB. And it's something that I think to some degree we have to be careful, more careful in the future than we have been in the past, of if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Somebody said, and I used to know who, but I'm getting old now, that people get the government they deserve. And in ACB, I think we've gotten the government that we deserve. A government that's careful, a government that's careful of respecting its affiliates and careful of respecting its members as an extension of those affiliates. I think governments that don't have the safeguards that we do tend not to treat their members as well as we treat ours. So we've got the government we deserve. It may not be perfect. I don't think there is a government in the world that is perfect. But as Brian suggests, I'm proud to be associated with ACB's Constitution. It's actually a pretty cool document, which protects the rights of people better than most. Thank you very much for participating in this somewhat theoretical discussion tonight. We've really enjoyed having all of you who were with us tonight. Remember, to get the government you deserve, vote in November. Good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.